people have had to endure as public a humiliation as James Fry. He's the author of the critically acclaimed best-selling book, A Million Little Pieces. Best-selling because Oprah chose it for her book club. It's a memoir of his time in rehab. Major parts of it turned out to be false. James Fry was savaged in the media, branded a liar, the butt of jokes, banished from the publishing world. It all culminated in a sit-down on Oprah's couch.
It is difficult for me to talk to you because I really feel duped.
I've struggled with the idea of it.
The lie of it. That's a lie. Not an idea, James.
That was in 2006. Now, 2 years later, James Fry is back with another book. This one is a novel. It's called Bright Shiny Morning, and it takes place in the land of fantasy, Los Angeles. James Fry joins me now in our Los Angeles studios. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. Now, you write in rather cheekily at the beginning of this novel, nothing in this book should be considered accurate or reliable.
First line of the book.
But you do stuff this book full of what you call fun facts. So really, nothing's true?
Some of it's true. Some of it's not. You know, it has a pretty complete history of the city of Los Angeles in it. And most of it's true, but some of it's not. Some of it I just made up.
But we'll never know unless we go and fact check it.
I mean, one thing that was sort of funny is when I was telling the publisher how I did it, they sort of freaked out. But they made me write a report going through the entire book. And sourcing every fact where I found it, and then telling them which ones were true, which ones weren't, which ones had been sort of embellished or manipulated, which ones hadn't. So there's now this 38-page report.
Wow. So kind of like a term paper on your novel.
Yeah. In a way. I mean, it was the most heavily vetted novel maybe in history. I mean, it was a joke, the lengths to which the publisher went, probably justifiably so, to make sure the book was correct.
I want to go back to that Oprah moment. And, you know, you could, after all, at that time, just laid low. You could have just not done the interview, but you did. And you went before millions of people. Why did you do that?
Oprah had had me on the show once and had been extremely generous to me and wanted me to come back, so I went back.
Did you expect what you got?
I'm not going to go into what I may or may not have expected. It was a long, hard day. It was a very long hour.
Yeah. There is an article about you in this month's Vanity Fair magazine. And from what I gleaned in the article, you originally shopped this book, A Million Little Pieces, as a novel. It seemed in this Vanity Fair article that your agent, your editor, even the publisher, Nan Talese, all decided it would be better for it to be a memoir. Is that what happened?
I mean, there are a lot of legal issues and restrictions related to my relationship with Random House and my relationship with Nan Talese. One thing I can say is in literally the first interview I ever gave in February of 2003, 2.5 months before A Million Little Pieces was initially released, I flatly stated to the New York Observer, I shop this book as fiction. Nan Talese declined to publish it as such. You know, and frankly, at this point, I don't even think it matters. You know, I feel like I've acknowledged the mistakes I made and I've learned from them and I've moved on, you know. I've got a new book and I'm proud of it and I'm happy with it.
Well, let's talk about that new book. It's called Bright Shiny Morning and it's set in Los Angeles. And tell me about the decision. Why did you decide to set this book in Los Angeles? And not just set it in Los Angeles, but make it really about Los Angeles.
I lived in L.A. for 8 years, and it's a city I love. You know, people outside of L.A. sort of think of L.A. as this place where there are a lot of movie stars and there are a lot of criminals, and they don't think much else about it. And so I wanted to try to write a book about this city that I loved. And, you know, it's a love letter that acknowledges the city has its faults and has things about it that aren't great, but it's still a love letter.
You know, obviously a big part of L.A. is its freeway system and its cars and its traffic. And you have a really great passage in there where you describe all the freeways and why they're called numbered freeways. The 10, the 101, the 405. Can you read a little bit?
Sure. Interstate 405, the San Diego Freeway, or the 405. Someone in the state of California's naming office was smoking weed when they named this road because it doesn't run within 40 miles of San Diego. It's almost as if they felt sorry for San Diego for not having any big famous roads on the scale of roads in L.A., so they decided to throw them a bone and give them a 405. Lucky for them, no one in L.A. gives a and no one in L.A. even bothers with the misleading and entirely inaccurate given name. The big 16-lane north-south artery, infamous as the scene of the O.J. Simpson slow-speed car chase of June 17, 1994, is and always will be known as the 405. As a proud citizen of Mar Vista, which borders the route of the 405, once uttered, that silly San Diego bull. It's our road, and we'll call it whatever the we want to call it.
Beep, 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 beep.
You told me to do it.
Well, tell me about the characters. You basically follow the lives of about four major characters.
There are sort of four primary narratives, and then there are hundreds of other characters. You know, the four primary narratives, I wanted to set them in different geographic locations of L.A., and I wanted them to sort of represent different archetypes of L.A. You know, there's a Mexican-American. You know, that Hispanic culture is obviously a massive thing in L.A. There is a homeless guy who lives on the beach. There is a movie star, and there's a young couple who comes to L.A. from a small town in the Midwest to sort of try to find their way and make their dreams come true. To tell the story of the city, you can't tell a single story. I just thought it was the most effective way to do what I wanted to do. You know, obviously some people think I did it very effectively, and the critic for the L.A. Times thought I did it disastrously, but it's all good.
Ooh!
Sorry.
That's okay.
That's embarrassing.
An L.A. moment.
Total.
An L.A. moment here. Is that your agent?
No. No.
You talk a lot about, in this book, you talk a lot about finding dreams, about L.A. being the repository for a lot of people's dreams, of people coming here to find something. And I'm wondering if writing this book, and maybe this is a little cliched in and of itself, but writing this book was a way for you to sort of find yourself after what happened to you after A Million Little Pieces.
I don't think of the book as a redemptive act, really. I mean, this book had actually been sold before the sort of controversy erupted. The contract for it was canceled. I decided after everything that happened that I was just going to write the same book. I was going to try to do the same thing the same way I was going to do if nothing had happened. I think what happened influenced the book for sure. I mean, it changed me a lot.
How so?
I mean, it was a profoundly humbling experience. It did make me sort of value hope more, value the idea of dreams more. You know, I've had dreams come true. I've had dreams sort of explode. L.A. is a symbol of it around the world. You know, when people think of L.A., they think that's where you go. And that's whether your dream is sort of international superstardom or your dream is, you know, a green card and a job.
So how come you don't live in L.A.?
I lived here for 8 years, you know. I could live here very, very happily. My wife is a New Yorker, and after we got married, she said, I want to go home. And like any smart husband...
You did what you were told.
I did what I was told. You know, we've talked about moving back. We might not. Who knows?
All right. James Frye, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's James Frye, author of the new book, Bright, Shiny Morning.
When Playboy magazine founder Hugh Hefner was interviewed for his 80th birthday, he said 80 is the new 40. A recently released documentary film is further proof of Hefner's statement. Young at Heart follows the lives of a group of 80-somethings who travel the world and sing covers of popular songs by The Clash, Coldplay, and the Bee Gees.
Whether you're a brother or whether you're a mother, you're staying alive.
It is also said that life doesn't end, it changes. After Dudley Clendenin's father died, his mother moved into Canterbury Tower, an elderly apartment nursing home complex in Tampa, Florida. As his mother's health declined, Clendenin began to spend most of his time there. A memoir of those years has just been published, A Place Called Canterbury, Tales of the New Old Age in America. And Dudley Clendenin joins us from member station WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm tickled to be here. Nice to talk to you.
Tell us briefly kind of a thumbnail history of this place called Canterbury.
It was built in about 1977-78, and it's 125 rooms in a tower, like a good apartment hotel, and then there's a low nursing wing of 60 beds. And it's called a life care or continuing care place. The simpler way to think of it, Leanne, is the last stop.
Hmm. What was a typical day like at this place when your mother was still, you know, moving around and actually living her life there?
That depends on who you're asking who lives there. If you looked at my mother's calendar for 1995, every day except 12 were filled with two or three or four things a day because that's the way she lived, even though she had several broken vertebrae and a fractured hip and some other infirmities all in that year. But there are some people, the opposite might be a man named Lewis. He was a chemist and contributed to the production of Valium and other things in those days. And he was afraid of germs, and so he never left the building, and he'd use implements to punch the buttons on the elevators and would avoid contact with people. So it depends on your life perspective. You can be as much a part of the world outside or live entirely within the confines of the building.
You write, it's a soap opera. I mean,
it is.
Yeah.
It
what
is.
What was an ongoing juicy story?
The ongoing story for me was how I was going to communicate with Mother and what she needed and wanted. She had become what everybody else was afraid of, you know, the stroke victim. and she was largely silent and just looked at me. Mm-hmm. And we had this continuing conversation in which I was more and more verbal and she was less and less. The drama in the tower, in the apartment tower, was Marion Wilbur, because Wilbur Davis, who loved being the New Year's baby in a diaper and who loved being Santa Claus at Christmas, had become the most articulated example of dementia I thought I might ever see. He was physically very active. He was a sweet soul. He loved being social. He loved talking. He just had no idea what he was talking about. And he and Mary observed the cocktail hour. And other people would come for cocktails, and he would insist on making the drinks, which he, if he actually made, might then drink himself, which drove people crazy, and people quit coming for cocktails. Those are the light stories, but the more serious part was, how is she going to treat this long relationship? Because she said, he is my only company. He has always been my company. We've been together for 68 years. And that's the question, you know, when one spouse begins to sort of become less and less competent, and you know the nursing wing is just down the hall and through three doors, how and when do you make that decision?
And Wilbur has to be separated from Mary, and you write about him. I mean, every time the elevator door opened, he thought that she would be coming through?
He thought she'd be coming through. She might leave the room for a moment, and then he would miss her. He might look in the other direction, and she might be sitting on the couch, and he in a chair, and he looked in the other direction and missed her and then went out the door and began looking for her. And you know, he was a very lovable soul, and people indulged him. And because they were all in that boat of old age together, you know, they were all declining in one way or another, and that's the tension. It's modeled in a way on a book that John D. McDonald did years ago, on a condominium building based in Sarasota called The Condominium. And the catalyst then was a hurricane which came bearing down on the condominium building and all the people who lived in it. In this case, it's a building full with people from different parts of the country and the world, and the catalyst is death looming or incompetence, old age bearing down on them.
Hmm. Have any of the current residents of Canterbury read this book?
Oh, they've almost all read it at this point.
You getting reviews?
Yeah, I am. I had a lot of concern about it, of course, but it is a funny, tender, surprisingly rich and imaginative book. It has all kinds of funny stories. Mary told half the building my mother was dead, and we all sort of mourned her. She was, in fact, watching Guy Lombardo on TV, and I said, I didn't know Guy Lombardo was still alive. And the activities director said, at Canterbury he is.
Uh-huh. And thereby hang many, many tales.
Yes.
How do you feel about growing old now?
I feel I feel wonderful having spent this time with my mother. It was 9 years of a far more intimate period of time than I would ever have had if she had not lived so long and declined in a way that needed me. When she finally died and gave the last chapter that this book needed, it left me completely at rest, having spent so much time with her. It also left me at rest with my own age. I'm now old enough to move into Canterbury. I've been writing this for 7 years. You know, in another 20 years, I may go there.
Really?
Or someplace.
Yeah?
Because the two things that my friends and I talk about is the fact in these last 10 or 15 years of the fact that, A, our parents are driving us crazy. They're getting old. We don't know how long they're going to last. We love them, and they worry us, and we've got to figure out how to help. And B, where are we going to go? And a place like Canterbury could be it.
Dudley Clendenin is the author of A Place Called Canterbury, Tales of the New Old Age in America, published by Viking. He spoke to us from the studio of member station WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leanne, very much.
Life's going nowhere. Somebody help me. Somebody help me. Yeah. Life's going nowhere. Somebody help me. Yeah. I'm staying alive.
I am Netta Ulaby. This week on Book Tour, we'll listen as author Tobias Wolff reads from his new collection of short stories, called, appropriately enough, Our Story Begins. One follows a man on a walk with his dog, Victor.
Victor was drawn to the obvious delights, putrefying carcasses, the regurgitations of hawks and owls, but he could just as easily get worked up over a clump of shrubbery that seemed no different than the one beside it. He had his nose stuck deep in swamp grass one damp morning when John saw a dog emerge alone from the low-hanging mist farther up the trail.
For the entire reading and discussion, and to hear other authors of fiction and nonfiction, please go to npr.org/booktour.
William P. Young wrote a little novel called The Shack a couple years ago as a gift for his kids. It was a way of dealing with some painful, traumatic events that happened in his own life, including being the victim of sexual abuse as a child. And it was his way of teaching his kids about his relationship with God. But something happened after he showed the book to a few friends. They told a few more friends, and a few more friends, and somebody said, hey, you really ought to publish this. So he and a couple of the friends did. Today, The Shack is the number 6 selling book on Amazon.com. It's been in USA Today's list of best-selling books for 15 weeks, and it's number 4 on Publishers Weekly's list of trade paperback bestsellers. Translation, it's popular, really popular. I'd give you the synopsis, but actually when I talked to William P. Young, who goes by his middle name, Paul, I got him to do it.
Basically, middle-aged guy, basically me. Middle-aged guy. I have 6 children. This character has 5 children. He goes on a camping trip with his 3 youngest children over Labor Day in eastern Oregon. A terrible tragedy occurs. There is some question about whether there has been an abduction or an actual murder because there's no body found. There's just this huge tragedy. And then he gets, 4 years later, he gets a note in the mailbox inviting him back to the locus of that tragedy, which is a shack in the middle of the Wallowa County in eastern Oregon. And the way the note is crafted, it could be a huge prank. It could be somebody with a terrible sense of humor, just a really devastating thing. It could be actually from the abductor or... The way it's written, it's possible that it's from God and inviting him back. And basically then is, how does he deal with this? What does he go back to find? How does he deal with the stuff in his own sadness with regard to the losses that he's had, not just with this event, but going back to his relationship with his own father and things like that.
You wrote this primarily as a gift for your kids, for your family back in 2005. And the only expectation you had was to simply get this story bound and created as a gift for your kids to open on Christmas.
Exactly.
How did this become something so much bigger? How in the world did that happen?
That's an understatement. Pretty much everything's an understatement in terms of what's happened. For me, the bottom line is there is a God who's involved in things like this. I mean, there is really no human explanation for some of what's going on here. No anticipation. I've never published anything in my whole life. I'm the most accidental author you'll ever meet. I've written always as gifts for friends and family, but poems and songs and short stories and cards and newsletters, all that kind of stuff. This, what has happened here, it's not even within the realm of expectation. I mean, this is totally not planned. This is totally not foreseen. This is, you know, even down the road when I originally began to share the electronic original manuscript version with friends and family, I started getting the feedback of how impacting it was for them. And that surprised me. And I still didn't know what to do about it. I had a few friends in California that Wayne Jacobson and Brad Cummings and Bobby Downs who began to encourage me more and more to do something with it, but I had no idea what that meant. And they helped me walk through a process of working on the manuscript, trying to get it to publishers who virtually all turned it down. Hmm. And then Wayne and Brad create Windblown Media as a for real publishing company with one title, The Shack. And
started shipping it from the garage, right?
Yeah, we still are shipping it from Brad's garage and two storage units in California.
Wow.
And to date, we've spent less than, you know, $300 in marketing and promotion. And we're right at 1 million copies. I mean, how is that possible?
So it's been largely word of mouth.
It's through relationships and people who care about people who are giving it to each other.
When I first picked up the book, I went into it knowing that this was had a large spiritual component to it. There was a very strong Christian narrative throughout the book. Is this a book for Christians?
It's a book for anybody. And people are resonating with the story regardless of their background. You know, my relationship with God comes out of a Protestant Christian matrix. And so I write from that quite a bit. But I think this book is way outside the box.
You have written that there are parts of you that are reflected in both characters, Willie and Mac, in this book. Paul, do you have a background in theology? Mac in the book definitely does. Is that something you share with that character?
Absolutely. I'm a missionary kid. I'm a preacher's kid. I went to Bible school, a couple years in seminary. So, you know, I've been inside church religious organizations virtually all my life. And so, yeah, I do share that.
Have you had moments and chapters in your life where you would not have, where your faith was not as strong, where you had more questions?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. And me and Mother Teresa, you know, yes, absolutely. I think all of us are in a process, and that's part of the beauty of this. I don't know anybody that's not in a process, and it appears that God really loves process. The Shack is more a parable than anything else. It's definitely a metaphor for the place you get stuck, hurt, damaged. You store your lies, you store your secrets. And you don't want to deal with it. You don't want to go back to the shack. You don't want to go to the locus of your pain. You want to try to avoid it, escape it, numb it, whatever you have to do. And it's God's intention, from my point of view, it's God's intention to crawl inside that place with us and heal us from the inside.
Another character in this book really is the great sadness. It's its own character. And it's this great weight that Matt carries with him of childhood trauma, and then the recent trauma that befalls him on that camping trip. You wrote this in part to communicate your own spiritual path and how you freed yourself from what was your own great sadness, correct?
Although I wouldn't say I freed myself. I don't think we're that smart. At least I'm not. You know, the history of my own pain and the shack, I mean, it took me 38 years to build the shack to the point where it was ready to just explode. And then it took me 11 years to go through it. So I squeezed that 11 years to a weekend with McKenzie. And, you know, I think that we are that every human being is so incredibly designed and such an amazing creation that God is the only one big enough to know how to unwind all the damage that has been perpetuated by both the choices of that person and what's been done to them. You know, I like to think of it as sort of this ball of yarn that is full of knots and knots inside of knots and other knots that are tangled in other parts of the yarn. And God is the only one that's big enough to take that ball of yarn and begin to untie all the knots and never break the string.
So this has, I am sure, changed your life in many different ways, unexpectedly. I'm hearing things like screenplay, movie. Is this really happening?
Yeah, that's a good question. Is this really happening? I mean,
I'm sure that means that question
has
Truman more than one
Show.
Meaning.
Oh, I know. I tell people, you know, it's like I'm on the Truman Show, and I'm the only one that doesn't know where the cameras are. And I mean, it is so outside the box. I mean, you just go back to the story and you think, okay, you have this guy who's not an author, doesn't have an identity as an author, doesn't know how to be an author, who writes a story for his kids, and then all of a sudden, this is happening. And yes, there is an audio book that's in the works. There is, you know, there's a dozen studios that are very interested in helping produce this as a major motion picture, not some little piece of work, but really a significant piece of work. And we're not in any hurry. We were never in any hurry about the book. We're not in any hurry about anything else. And we want to be sensitive. You know, the prayer that I prayed in 2005 when I'm coming out of my shack is basically, God, I don't want to ask you to bless anything that I do anymore. But if you're blessing something, and it'd be okay for me to hang around. And that sense has just permeated this entire process. This story did everything that I wanted it to when I gave it to my six children.
The book is called The Shack. It was written by William P. Young, who goes by Paul, and Paul joined us today. Paul, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Loved being with you. Thank you so much.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.